everyone. Thank you for tuning in to the Postmodern Realities Podcast, brought to you by the Christian Research Institute and the Christian Research Journal. I'm Melanie Cogdill, Managing Editor of the Christian Research Journal. It's November 2022, and you're listening to episode 314, which is a conversation about the Amazon Prime series Rings of Power, which takes place in J.R.R. Tolkien's Middle Earth. Today's guest is Cole Burgett, who is a graduate of Dallas Theological Seminary and the Moody Bible Institute. Cole teaches classes in systematic theology and Bible exposition and writes extensively about theology and popular culture. Cole has written an online exclusive TV series review for the Christian Research Journal, and his article is called Tolkien Reimagined, a series review of The Lord of the Rings, The Rings of Power. Our subscribers can read his review for free at our website, equip.org. The reason why they can read it for free is every subscription includes both our print issue to your door, but also all the access to the online exclusive articles, and you will be able to read those for our subscribers at equip.org. If you'd like to read this review and you don't already subscribe, of course, go to equip.org to do so. Cole, it's good to have you on again.
It's always good to be here. Thank you.
Well, as our listeners might know, this particular series that is on Amazon Prime has been quite heralded, also quite reviled by Lord of the Rings fans, but it's been with great anticipation that Tolkien fans and Lord of the Rings fans have been looking forward to this new live-action adaptation that was actually sanctioned by the Tolkien family, their executive producers on it, that this would be another, you know, chapter in the whole Middle Earth saga. And some of our listeners might not know that much about Lord of the Rings. I mean, they might know that there's movies, but some people are not necessarily fantasy fans. So can you start by giving us a broad overview of the Lord of the Rings trilogy and what it's about? And why is it just really one of those hallmark works, not just for Christian fiction, but also fantasy fiction?
Sure. So the Lord of the Rings is a popular fantasy series of novels written by J.R.R. Tolkien, John Ronald Reuel Tolkien, that originally began as a sequel to Tolkien's 1937 children's fantasy book, The Hobbit. But the story eventually developed into this bigger work and was published as a trilogy between the years of 1954 and 1955. And there are three major books in that trilogy: The Fellowship of the Ring, The Two Towers, and The Return of the King. And each of those books are really composed of two smaller books. So there are technically six books there, I guess, but everyone knows them by the trilogy in which they were published. But it's important to understand that this trilogy, like The Hobbit, really only composed a small section of Tolkien's world, his legendarium, as it's often called. And there is another major text that Tolkien wrote called The Silmarillion, which expands his fantasy world of Middle Earth. And there are snippets of details of events covered in The Silmarillion contained within The Lord of the Rings in these sections of appendices, which really help to flesh out Tolkien's world for readers only interested in the trilogy proper. Now, when the books were first published, the reception was fairly lukewarm. But over time, given the book's influence on the now extremely popular fantasy genre, in many ways, Tolkien shaped modern fantasy into its current form. Critics have since reevaluated the series, and now it's considered one of the best works of Western fiction out there. The books are among the best-selling of all time and are noted for their themes echoing the values of Christianity. The stories are steeped in mythology, which again draws parallels between myth and the Christian faith, which we have discussed at length on this podcast in other episodes. But if there is an actual work you can point to that draws Christian values into the realm of mythopoeia, or myth making in a modern context, there is no better work to point to than The Lord of the Rings. I've often said that if you enjoy modern fantasy in any way, shape, form, or fashion, then you can think The Christians and a Texan, the Texan being Robert E. Howard, the creator of Conan the Barbarian, who is hugely influential in a pre-Tolkien world, and The Christians being C.S. Lewis and his friend J.R.R. Tolkien.
A lot of fantasy and sci-fi lovers, you know, Christians and people who are not religious, kind of lump all of these worlds to be the same. In other words, well, there's Star Wars, and there's Star Trek, and there's Marvel, and then there's Lord of the Rings. Do you think that Lord of the Rings as a constructed world is different than some of those more contemporary examples?
Oh, for sure. It all sort of plays in the realm of fantasy in one sense, but there's no denying that Tolkien's world is usually a little more, let's say, thought out than many of the others. And that comes in part from his interest and his background, which we'll talk about. But the Lord of the Rings is quite different from something like Marvel or something like Star Wars, even though they all sort of have their toes in the same pond. The way that these things are written and the specific, I guess, what we would now call subgenres, really stand as a testament to that. Star Wars, for example, is a kind of space opera. It takes inspiration from Flash Gordon and stories like that, which are these fantasy worlds, but really in space, and operate quite differently from the world that Tolkien creates, Middle Earth. Tolkien's world is, in many ways, the let's say the codifier of what modern fantasy is now. Game of Thrones, for example, has gotten a lot of attention for being very subversive these days, but that is only because it subverts the tropes that have been copied for almost 100 years in fantasy writing. And those tropes were codified, if you will, in the modern fantasy lexicon by Tolkien and The Lord of the Rings. This is where Dungeons and Dragons will find its origins. This is where most modern fantasy video games will find their origins as well. It is impossible to talk about the state of modern fantasy without touching upon Robert Howard, C.S. Lewis, and J.R.R. Tolkien, and The Lord of the Rings is the big work of that. So in that respect, it has sort of carved out its niche in all of these subgenres in what we now call high fantasy, which is a very detailed historical, maybe medieval type world that is, you know, distinctly different from, say, Star Wars or the modern world of Marvel. But another thing just to point out here, when these guys were writing these works, there was no such thing really as a lot of what we would call genre studies today. And in a lot of ways, I think that's sort of why these books kind of stand the test of time, because what they were doing was truly unique in their own time. When Tolkien sat down to write The Lord of the Rings, he was crafting a fantasy. He was writing a fantasy. He was doing mythopoeia, or myth-making, world-building, we might call it. But he was not sitting down and consciously saying, I am going to write within this genre of fantasy, within a specific subgenre of that fantasy, so that I'm going to follow all of these genre tropes to write this kind of story. That is what we do now. That is what writers do now as a result of the work that Tolkien did with The Lord of the Rings. And that's what I mean when I say that he sort of fashioned modern fantasy into what it is. You can't really have these conversations about the state of the genre, really, without looking at Tolkien. So I think he's very different in terms of what he's doing from all of these other, what we might call modern fantasies, in that he really was writing a very new thing, but doing it in a very old way. It's just in the world of genre studies, this stuff gets pretty fascinating.
I want to remind our listeners, because some of them are probably newer and it's been a while, but I last talked about Tolkien's early life when we looked at the fictional biopic called Tolkien many years ago. And that was, if listeners are interested, way back almost 200 episodes ago in episode 123 that we called Tolkien's First Fellowship. So if you're interested in finding out even more than what we briefly discuss here, I would suggest that you go back into our archives and pull up that episode. But right now I want to ask Cole a little bit about the life of J.R.R. Tolkien and, of course, his faith, since he was a Christian. And he was well known to have connection to other Christian writers at the time, most notably, of course, C.S. Lewis, and then also another writer named Charles Williams. Can you tell us a little bit about his association with him and his faith?
Yeah, Tolkien was a lifelong Catholic and a very devout one. He was in the First World War and experienced many of those horrors firsthand, and there's a lot of scholarship out there discussing how his experiences in the war influenced The Lord of the Rings. But his interests were in philology, or the study of languages and historical records. Philology is an interesting field. It sort of stands at the crossroads of textual and literary criticism and history and etymology, but it has this historical focus on languages. And it's out of that interest that Tolkien actually created the languages of Middle-earth, which really helped to heighten the reality of the fantasy world he created. This is a world with its own languages and people and customs and cultures and histories. It's world building, as it's often called now. But Tolkien was an absolute master of the craft. He ended up at Oxford as the Merton Professor of English Language and Literature. And that's how he fell in with the likes of C.S. Lewis and Charles Williams. He became a member of the Inklings, this group of literature enthusiasts who met and discussed different things. Tolkien actually played a very key role in converting Lewis to the faith, and it had a lot to do with this topic of mythology and myth and Christianity. Tolkien was very steeped in literature and language and mythology, and his conversations with Lewis about those topics ended up leading Lewis to faith in part, even though Tolkien was a Catholic and Lewis was an Anglican. So with The Lord of the Rings, you can begin to see how all of his personal interests and convictions and beliefs begin to coalesce into a kind of fantasy world, and it's really fascinating.
I think one thing that some Christians might assume is that the styles of writing like Lewis and Tolkien were related because they knew each other. For example, the Chronicles of Narnia by C.S. Lewis are considered children's literature and a work for children. And of course, as you mentioned, The Hobbit was a story originally for children. And so people assume that the whole world of Middle Earth is just like Narnia and kind of a Christian allegory. So I think Christian readers are expecting is there a character like Aslan who's Jesus, or does Gandalf represent Moses or a prophet or something like that in the Bible? And, you know, is Sauron really Satan? So is it true? Do they have a similar literary style, or is the work of Tolkien and C.S. Lewis very different in some respects?
So this is a really fascinating question. The question of allegory, which always seems to come up in these discussions. And I'll tackle this in broad strokes first, and then we'll try to get into some of the details of it. From a very broad perspective, Tolkien would say no, that The Lord of the Rings is not allegory. that allegory he really wasn't even a huge fan of. He tried to think of things more in the context of literature and history, which he believes allowed for a kind of depth of thought that allegory did not. That being said, when a lot of this stuff started out in some of his early letters, he actually did sort of call The Lord of the Rings a kind of allegory of power. But then later on, he would sort of revise his opinion and say that it wasn't so much a story about power, but a story about death and immortality or deathlessness. And so Tolkien himself, you can see, I don't want to say he sort of waffled back and forth, because that's really not what he did, but he sort of over time revised his opinion of his own work. And I will say it like this. I think the reason he sort of struggled with the idea of his work as allegory is because it's not as, if it is an allegory, it is not as blatant an allegory as something like the Chronicles of Narnia, where there are very clear one-to-one correlations between the story being told and, say, the story of Christianity. Aslan is very clearly Jesus. His life sort of mirrors Jesus's, in a sense, his sacrifice mirrors Jesus's, stuff like that. But it continually goes on in that regard. Tolkien's creation is not like that. All of his characters, or at least several of his main characters, you can find embody facets of Christ, some even more than others. There's a lot of scholarship on this, looking at Gandalf, Frodo, and Aragorn from The Lord of the Rings, for example, as being a kind of exemplary of Christ's threefold office of prophet, priest, and king in different ways. And so there's not one specific corollary that fits, that would allow it to be called a kind of allegory. But this is a very popular debate to have: is The Lord of the Rings an allegory? And I think there's certainly arguments to be made for both sides. But at the end of the day, I'm probably going to look at what the author is saying and look at authorial intent more than anything else. And by the end of his life, it seems that Tolkien did not think of it as an allegory, at least in the same sense that the Chronicles of Narnia were an allegory, that it was more a very unique kind of fantasy fiction in which his Christian faith came out very strongly. And it's not even that he writes religion into his world. This is another very interesting thing that Tolkien talks about in his letters. But he doesn't even put religion in The Lord of the Rings in the traditional fantasy sense of these different cults and things like that. And I say traditional fantasy, ironically enough, meaning, the fantasy that comes after Tolkien that does this kind of thing. But he sort of intentionally excised these references to religion in that respect. And his reason for doing that was to just make it part of the warp and woof of the world that he created. It's a very interesting idea there that a lot of fantasy after Tolkien doesn't seem to even come close to grasping, that the idea of faith and the gods, or the God, as he would say, is key in his own work. It is just there and is part of the warp and woof of the fantasy world he writes. A lot of writers after him would have no conception of how to even wrap their minds around that and to write that into their literature. So in that respect, it's not an allegory. It's something else entirely, but I certainly think there's room for people to debate that particular point, because it seems that Tolkien himself even debated it throughout his life.
You're listening to the Postmodern Realities Podcast, brought to you by the Christian Research Journal. I just want to let you know that we don't take it for granted for all the ways that you partner with us, which is to subscribe to the Christian Research Journal at equip.org, or to head on over there at equip.org to give us a tip at any one of the landing pages at the podcast, which you can find under the journal tab. And also just for helping us out with some of your time, frankly, to share episodes on your social media feeds or to simply tell a friend about the podcast or email someone a link to your favorite episode. And of course, to take the time to give us a rating or review on Apple Podcasts. And so for all of these things, we're really grateful for those because we couldn't continue bringing this podcast to you for free without your partnership. So thanks for your time, for your investment, and for your listening ears. And now back to the interview with Cole. I think it's significant that such a major work of fantasy fiction by a very devout Christian is now one of the biggest franchises and definitely has been branded on so many different kinds of products and films and things like that. And that's fascinating to me. I mean, one thing to note for our listeners is that The Rings of Power is the most expensive television show ever made. I think they're going to be spending close to $1 billion, perhaps. So given that it's just so much in the cultural milieu, and then people have at least heard of Lord of the Rings and some of its characters, or at least the hobbits, people have a general vague understanding of what that is. So it's really penetrated pop culture. How can Christians in particular approach the Rings of Power in a way that they can encourage discussions of faith and some of the issues that are brought up, sacrifice and friendship and things like that, even with non-believers in the context of the world of Middle Earth?
The Lord of the Rings is perhaps one of the best vehicles for moving into discussions of faith. And that is simply because Tolkien himself said in several of his letters that the series is deeply religious and influenced by his faith. So this is one of those areas of pop culture where Christians really do have a valid say in terms of criticism or just discussion, simply because The Lord of the Rings is a deeply Christian work, and that comes by the admission of the guy who wrote it himself. This, taken alongside the fact that the fantasy genre is more popular now than it ever has been, is like an open invitation for Christians to step into conversations about faith. And the common ground, if you will, is one's interest in this fantasy world Tolkien has created. And just to give a very practical example of this, I actually have a friend who's a Marine who recently discovered Tolkien's world by virtue of the Peter Jackson films. And this guy is more of an agnostic. But we have been able to have very interesting conversations about evil and its pervasiveness in the world because of how Tolkien portrays it. I know that you had mentioned when we were talking about the series before that some of reading Tolkien is quite dark. It's very different from Narnia in that way. Some of the stuff is actually very scary. And this is one of the things that I talked about with my friend. And for anyone who knows the story at the end of The Lord of the Rings, Frodo cannot return home and find contentment in the way that his friend can, simply because he has been touched so profoundly by evil in their adventure. And that was Tolkien's great conviction about the character of Sam, who does manage to come home after their adventure and pick up a very ordinary life and live it with contentment. And this idea really shook my friend to his core, and the conversations we've had about the ordinariness of goodness, which is a very biblical idea, have led to him talking more about faith in a very mature but roundabout way than I think he's ever been accustomed to. And that's just one story. There are plenty of people out there who have so many stories like that about how Tolkien's world and its deeply Christian images and themes have led to conversations about faith with atheists, agnostics, even people of other religions. So I think Christians disregard the Rings of Power at their own disadvantage. And not everyone involved in the show itself is a Christian, I'm sure, but the showrunners have talked about their deep admiration for Tolkien and wanting to hew as closely to his world as they can when adapting the material. So it's not like they're out here, you know, cutting out Christianity from the show we have to recognize that the show is an adaptation, and Tolkien is the man of faith whose source material is really where the good stuff is. But the show is certainly a doorway to all manner of conversations about faith.
I want to ask you now about the actual series, The Rings of Power, which is streaming on Amazon. And I would assume a lot of people are Amazon Prime members. You can watch it there. So how is this particular series different from the very well-regarded Peter Jackson popular film series that was nominated for Oscars? And how does the storyline fit into the broader mythology of Middle Earth that Tolkien created? One thing I think some watchers might not know is this is based on some smaller material in the appendices of the Lord of the Rings series, which a lot of readers probably skip because it seems more mundane, or a lot of different, you know, just historical notes and more history. But there's a lot of room there for things that are happening. And maybe you can explain to us kind of the different broad history ages in The Lord of the Rings so people can be familiar of where the Rings of Power is taking place in that historical timeline.
Sure. So we'll start talking just briefly about where it fits with regards to the film adaptations. Like you said, the very popular Peter Jackson films. It's how most people know The Lord of the Rings. They were very, very popular films. Won something like 17 Academy Awards. The Return of the King won Best Picture. Like it was a big deal back in the early aughts. But even though this is an adaptation of Tolkien's material, it is not a continuation of the film trilogies. There were the two trilogies, the Lord of the Rings, and then The Hobbit was also done as a trilogy, which The Hobbit being a prequel to The Lord of the Rings. But this series, The Rings of Power, does not stand in that continuity of those films. That being said, it does deal with a time that it would, in a sense, be a prequel to those other stories. And this is where we'll sort of get into the details of Tolkien's world. So Tolkien's world is very expansive. I'll say that up front. I know some people are probably very familiar with this. But the events of The Lord of the Rings, the series that everybody sort of knows, the big trilogy, occurs during the Third Age of Middle Earth. And Middle Earth is the world in which Tolkien has made, and there are different ages that he sort of uses to date certain events in his world. So the trilogy proper takes place during the Third Age, and that's the one everybody sort of is familiar with. The Rings of Power, however, goes earlier. It actually takes place in what is known as the Second Age. So the Second Age comes about with the defeat of Morgoth, sort of the original great dark lord in Tolkien's Legendarium. But the villain that everybody sort of knows from The Lord of the Rings, Sauron, that character in Tolkien's world is one of Morgoth's lieutenants. And so during the Second Age, Sauron is in Middle Earth, sort of plotting his return to power of sorts. And this is the age in which the rings that are, you know, crucial to the Lord of the Rings are forged. And obviously this is what the show is going to deal with, considering its title, the forging of those legendary rings. So it's set in the Second Age after the defeat of Morgoth, when Sauron is out there somewhere. It's a big plot point in the series that they're trying to figure out what happened to him or where he is and that kind of thing. But also during the Second Age, you have a lot of the history that makes up the Lord of the Rings taking place. So the story of Numenor and these other stories that are part of the history of the world in the original trilogy. This is where a lot of that stuff occurs. So it's a prequel to The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings in the timeline, but it, as an adaptation, it stands on its own, separate from the other adaptations that have been made. Now, in terms of where the showrunners, the developers, Amazon really is getting their material, this is maybe one of the big areas of misunderstanding, because a lot of the events that are depicted in the series also occur in the Silmarillion, the book we talked about before, that is sort of Tolkien's companion piece to The Lord of the Rings. He kind of saw this as one great narrative, and The Lord of the Rings was just a part and parcel of that story. But the actual adaptation is not of the Silmarillion, which I think is where a lot of people sort of kind of get offended, or they seem that it seems like Amazon and the showrunners are taking these huge creative liberties because it doesn't line up tit for tat with the events of the Silmarillion. It's because they don't actually own the rights to that. What they have the rights to, in my understanding of this, is The Lord of the Rings. That's why it's titled The Lord of the Rings of Power, not the Silmarillion, The Rings of Power. So the material that they have to work with and that they are allowed to adapt all has to come from these appendices sections of The Lord of the Rings, which is where Tolkien sort of enfleshes a little bit what goes on in Middle Earth during the Second Age, but outside of the Silmarillion. That's what they're working with, and that's what they're adapting. So that's just a point of clarification, but might help some people to sort of understand exactly how the creatives are going about making the show.
And in the appendices, there's a lot of broad strokes. It's not like kind of a big story that like you're finding in The Lord of the Rings. So there is more room for them to make adaptations. And so there are quite a few characters introduced or reintroduced at a different stage of their life in The Rings of Power. So, for example, one of the most prominent and I would say main characters of The Rings of Power is Galadriel, and she's played by actor Morford Clark in the series, and then Cate Blanchett in the Peter Jackson films. And, you know, tell us a little bit about Galadriel, and I would also say she's the portrayal of her in The Rings of Power has received probably the most blowback from Lord of the Rings fans because they say her character is nothing like how she's portrayed in the actual books proper, and the way in which she has this fierce petulance is just nothing like her character in Tolkien's work. Would you agree with that?
So the liberties taken with this character are fairly interesting. She's a much younger elf than when we meet her in Peter Jackson's films, for example, and Tolkien's original trilogy. But she is an elf, so they have this longevity of life. So though she's, you know, much younger, she doesn't really look that much younger, even though it's, you know, hundreds and hundreds of years.
Oh, I think it's like thousands of years, actually.
Yeah, it is. It's a huge span of time, but that's how elves are. So she is this elf, and she's a very important figure in Tolkien's legendarium. Her daughter, for example, actually becomes the wife of Elrond and the mother of Arwen, who marries Aragorn, the king of Gondor and the Lord of the Rings. And in Tolkien's world, she ultimately comes to possess one of the rings of power. But in the series, she is presented as this kind of warrior on this vendetta to find Sauron. And her motivation in the series for that has everything to do with the death of her brother, Finrod, which is in Tolkien's works. But it's exploring her life as a very young elf. And in the books, for example, she has a husband who has not even been mentioned or introduced in the series yet. But one of the things that I think plays into some of the criticism here is that the showrunners had to take different events of the timeline in the Second Age, which in Tolkien's legendarium occur hundreds, if not thousands of years apart, and sort of condense them down as to all kind of happening at the same time in order to generate narrative tension and to keep the story moving. So it's kind of hard to say if the series is going to, and I'm assuming it will, grow her into the Galadriel we sort of know from Tolkien's works or the Jackson films, if it's going to grow her into this more regal figure who is less of this tempestuous warrior type. And it, yeah, who knows? I'm sure the series will probably move in that direction somewhat. It's only in its first season, and I think there's something like 5 seasons planned. But she is a very important character in Tolkien's Legendarium, and it's very interesting narratively to single her out and make her one of the main characters of these events unfolding in the Second Age. So do I think that the show is sort of portraying her quite different from how Tolkien wrote her? Yes. That being said, there's very likely a sense in which she will grow into the character that Tolkien envisioned and Cate Blanchett portrays in the films. And the evidence you see of that is, if for those of you who've seen the show, is in the lessons that she's learning. Her rage, in a sense, her desire for revenge is sort of blinding her to some things that are sort of right in front of her face. And she's having to sort of learn to temper that, in a sense. And but what I think the show has done so interestingly with her is to show the infectious nature of evil. That is a recurrent theme in her storyline as the series goes on, is that because of the evil that has been visited upon Middle-earth, because of the evil that took her brother's life, this drive for revenge she now feels, this drive to avenge her brother, is actually a manifestation of an evil that is now in her as a result of the evil that came in. So it's again, it's that idea of the pervasiveness of evil, that what might be mistaken as a good and righteous venture is actually not very good and righteous at all. And this is one of the things that Tolkien does extremely well. And I think it sort of begins to show that even though the showrunners are taking liberties as creatives, and it's going to happen in any adaptation, even though those liberties are being taken, that they still sort of understand the heart of what Tolkien is getting at as a storyteller, which is that the answer to a great and overwhelming evil is not a great and overwhelming goodness equal in power, but it is an ordinary goodness. It is a goodness that disarms evil of its weapons in that sense. And this is why Frodo can return home and Sam can return home, and Sam can find contentment in the ordinary despite having gone on this great adventure. He is changed, but not so much changed that he cannot return and just live a very basic bare bones life content with a wife and kids. Frodo just can't find that because of the evil that touched him on their journey. And it requires their stories eventually go in different ways. So there's one of the things you'll notice about the Rings of Power is that a lot of the same themes that echo throughout the Lord of the Rings are done, but in very different ways. Sometimes there's an inverse, a mirror image of a relationship. For example, you see with Aragorn and Arwen, the forbidden love between the man and the female elf has been flipped in the Rings of Power with these two new characters, Rondwin and Arondir. You have the male elf and the female woman and the forbidden romance. It's the mirror image of sorts. It's just interesting stuff.
I do want to ask you about that last character, because some of the critiques from fans out there and some, you know, television critics are saying that it seems tacked on to have these non-canonical characters that aren't actually part of the world of the Lord of the Rings as created by Tolkien. And one of those is the elf Arondir, and the other one is a different elf who's kind of like a bad guy named Adar. And so they feel like this brings the story down. What do you think about the showrunners and the creatives creating these new characters that aren't just side characters, but they're main characters in the storytelling of the Rings of Power?
Yeah, well, at the end of the day, I think I'm a much more forgiving film goer than a lot of people. And maybe this just comes from a standpoint of having written screenplays myself, and not just screenplays, but adaptations of works that are hard to adapt. As an adaptation, there are certain liberties that are going to be taken. And there is a sense in which, as a writer or a creative, you don't simply want to do what Tolkien did exclusively. At that point, the solution is not to adapt it. It's to just tell people, go read the books. There's a sense in which you take it and put your own spin on it or put your own stamp on it while trying to honor the legacy of what has come from before. And looking at it from that perspective, I would say that these writers are not it is tacked on in a sense, because obviously they're adding it to, but in another sense, it's added to, but with an eye to what has come before. Again, the whole storyline between Arondir and Bronwyn, it's an inverse of Aragorn and Arwen. It's a sort of setting up and an exploration of the same thing Tolkien explored from another angle. It's another direction. It's looking at it through a different set of eyes. And it's just interesting as a creative in that sense, in a way of honoring what's come before, but doing something unique and different with it. And there are a lot of criticisms about the elf, the inclusion of Adar, whatever you want to call him, the villain. However, I would also point out that some of this stuff is a filling in of the gaps of what is going on in Middle-earth at the time. And it's clear that his story ties into Sauron in some way, shape, form, or fashion. In fact, the work that they sort of carry out leads to the creation of Mount Doom and the creation of Mordor, in a sense, which is where we see Sauron going at the very end of the series. So in that respect, do I think that there are liberties being taken? Yes, of course. But do I think that they are breaking the world that Tolkien created? No, I don't. I think they actually have a very good grasp on the stories that Tolkien told and are interested in exploring those themes in different ways. Personally, one of my biggest complaints about the series is just the dialogue. I think some of the dialogue is so, it's not even that it's stilted. It's that it's just contrived and almost cliched in some places. Which the irony there, right, is reading Tolkien. A lot of people say, well, Tolkien's dialogue is cliched. Well, yeah, that's only because you've read fantasy that has modeled itself after Tolkien for 75 years now. Like, so in that sense, of course, it's going to sound cliched because he was the guy who started it. So it was original when he did it. But even then, just some of the dialogue feels very modern in a sense, and not even in the way that Peter Jackson and Fran Walsh wrote the dialogue in their films, which I thought was very good. Just some of the dialogue is predictable. It's very predictable. I actually was playing the series, watching it, and one of my family members walked into the room and has never watched the show, has no interest in it, but was listening to what some of the characters were saying and actually said the very next words that one of the characters was going to say. And we laughed about it because it was so cliched in the dialogue. She knew exactly what was going to be said. That being said, though, I don't think the show is really doing anything that's going to destroy Tolkien's legacy.
I do think that some of the dialogue is kind of signposty, is how I'd call it. But I do think the acting is good in that they're trying to make the best of some of that kind of type of dialogue. But in addition to the critique of these non-canonical characters being main characters, there's been a lot of criticism of the series, so much so that Amazon actually had to turn off the commenting on the episodes because it was getting so bad and just in the tone of the critiques. But the fans have been saying everything from the timeline is unrealistic, everything's happening too quickly. There's been a lot of critique of the ethnicity of the characters because they are using various different ethnic actors to be hobbits or elves, and people are not thinking that's in line with what they thought the vision of Tolkien was. And, you know, to the clothes that they're wearing, to what they're called, they're not called hobbits, they're called Harfoots, and all these kinds of different things that they're not liking. The humans in Numenor are supposed to be these giants, and they're just like average people having bar fights, and just they don't have the regalness that is portrayed by Tolkien. And so how would you address that? Because it's, you know, like I said, they've had enough critique to turn off the comments.
Yeah, well, as I said before, you have to recognize that this is an adaptation. And if you want how Tolkien did it, then simply go read how Tolkien did it. And I understand that there's a sort of a gray area there where you're saying, well, if you're going to adapt something, then why adapt it if you're just going to change a lot of it? But again, I don't think the changes are substantial enough to warrant someone just turning it off, especially a Christian, because of the, if you're thinking about it from the perspective of the culture wars, which we have lost, by the way, it's over, we lost. You've got to sort of take your victories where you find them. And this is a very much a victory in the sense that you have the most expensive television show ever produced being that of an adaptation of a work of a Christian, a very devout Christian. That is something to pay attention to. And I can understand a lot of the complaints that people have, some of them, others I don't. The complaints about the ethnicities, I don't really, I just, that's just not something that bothers me. I understand that when Tolkien was sitting down to write his Legendarium, that he sort of envisioned it as the mythological history of Britain. And so you would logically only have a very specific kind of ethnicity there. But even the history of Britain is muddled in very different kinds of ethnicities. And I know this because that's my own history and I've looked into it and it gets impossible to track after a certain point. But some of the criticisms, I don't know. I think we live in a point in time in, I hate even using the word of fandoms, but we live in a time where fandoms are sort of rampant. And there is a sense in which fans feel a sense of ownership of material that is just not theirs. I don't know how else to really say it. I understand the material is beloved to them, but there's a reason rights work the way rights work, and rights go to certain people and not others. So there's a sense that you just roll with the punches, I guess is what I'm saying. That being said, if you're going to pick things out to fight about, I would probably start at the level of themes. I would ask myself, does the story that I am watching really understand what Tolkien himself says he was trying to do with the stories that he was telling? And that would be my starting point, not the characters' hairstyles, even though that is a criticism I have read about. Apparently the hairstyles of the female dwarves in the series has come under serious criticism for not being outlandish enough. And, you know, I just think, grow up.
Well, I want to talk to you about one of the biggest spoilers, which is the very last episode. And so if you have not watched the last episode and don't want to be spoiled, please turn off the podcast now and then come back once you've finished watching it. But I want to talk a little bit about Sauron, because for sure in the Peter Jackson films, he is portrayed as this bodiless, evil presence that's just terrifying. And you don't really, he's not somebody you can actually see. So what about how Sauron is portrayed in The Rings of Power, and why do, again, some of the fans and viewers of the show find this controversial? One thing too is in, I don't know if it was in the Silmarillion or in the appendices, but at one point Sauron does think, well, I'll try to turn over a leaf and, you know, stop my evil ways, except for he got really bored. So he went back to being, you know, evil. But in the series, it kind of is flipped. You've talked about things that are flipped. It's, he's this character that's struggling with, it seems to me, something that he's not exactly expressing verbally, especially he has a relationship when he meets Galadriel, but with her, and they strike up kind of a, I would not a fellowship exactly, but they're kind of, you know, a partners together into trying to do something in Middle Earth. And so it seems to me this character is not really being portrayed until he's unveiled as this really big bad.
Yeah. So the portrayal of Sauron in this show has been one of the bigger curveballs. That being said, in Tolkien's world during the Second Age, there is a point in time where Sauron is actually, you know, walking around on 2 feet. He's not this disembodied spirit, but he actually does have corporeal form. And that's actually part and parcel to Tolkien's original story. He becomes disguised as this elf named Annatar that deceives Celebrimbor and sort of teaches these elven smiths the ways of crafting these rings, which leads to the creation of the rings. And then he goes and creates the One Ring that becomes the plot device for the original trilogy. But in this series, he does have corporeal form, but he is not disguised as an elf, at least not yet. There's very much room in the series that he does come back as Annatar and all of that goes on. But as it stands in the series currently, the big twist at the end of the first season is that one of the characters that we've sort of assumed has been a human working with Galadriel this entire time is actually Sauron, who she has been hunting for the whole season. And there's a lot of stuff that is hinted at there in their final conversation about what he is struggling with. Like you said, it's almost like he's having this very crisis of identity almost that I'm sure will be developed as the series goes on. The only issue with how the writers have chosen to tell this particular story in revealing Sauron at the very end is that his motivations are sort of muddled. We're not really sure what he's thinking or doing or struggling with because they've kept him hidden all season only to bring him out at the very end. So I'm sure the stuff that you're talking about will be addressed, sort of kind of like has to be addressed in the next seasons. But his portrayal in this show is quite different, at least so far, from how Tolkien wrote his portrayal as the elf in the Second Age. But in terms of, you know, someone who is sort of walking around silver-tongued and deceiving people, that's all there in Tolkien's Legendarium.
So I just want to circle back to one of my earlier questions just about all the different kinds of fantasy worlds that have been built since Middle Earth. I mean, why do you think The Lord of the Rings is so timeless? And, you know, I mentioned, you know, Star Wars and Star Trek and things like that, as well as any kind of worlds out of comic book adaptations, of course, and also Game of Thrones that you mentioned from George R.R. Martin, because that's kind of like been compared to it, a more crass version of The Lord of the Rings. But what makes his world unique among all these things? I think one for me is that he's the originating point because of his interest in languages and his really great intellect, that he could create a history that is so detailed, that's believable, that could be a history of peoples with all these different races and so forth in his world. And some of these more pop culture things have been created and they are being written by various different people. Well, except for Star Trek, it had Roddenberry at the beginning, but just different people working on it. So why do people want to return again and again to The Lord of the Rings and also have become such ardent fans, even if they are, you know, atheists, they're fans of this? And why does it seem like it's just always something that can be adapted or expanded upon for every new generation in pop culture?
Well, I think you've hit the nail on the head when you were talking about his interest in languages and his intellect. The singular creative vision that Tolkien had and the way that he brought his interests in history into line with his creative vision is sort of like every creative's dream, if that makes sense. It's a way to bring everything you have an interest in together in the creation of a singular work of great literature. And the depth and the texture of the world that he created stems from his desire to, as I said, sort of create a kind of mythology for Britain, which he felt was sort of lacking. You had the Greek myths, you had the Roman myths. Where was Britain's great mythology? And he set out to kind of, in a sense, imagine that. And so you have this sense in which mythology and faith and creativity all sort of coalesce into something which is really fantastic, you know, parts, but is something greater than the sum of its parts. And that's why people return to it, not only in that he's the originator of so much of this, but just because it's so well done. I think, in a way, The Lord of the Rings is proof positive of the very thing that Tolkien taught Lewis that opened the doorway for Lewis coming to faith. And you said it yourself, there are people who are agnostics, who are atheists, who are really great fans of Tolkien's world and his works. And it was that very thing that began to woo Lewis to Christianity, is Tolkien talking to him about mythology and the connection between mythology and faith. It's ultimately the thing that would lead Lewis to conclude that Christianity is the quote-unquote true myth, capital T, capital M, that the mythological story that actually transpires in human history that draws us, as he says, further up and further in, is that really wonderful expression Lewis uses. And Tolkien's world, the Lord of the Rings, his legendarium, just as a whole, sort of proves his point in that by having these people who do not share his faith falling in love with this mythological world that he's created, which is shot through with Christian themes and ideas and images and values, and Tolkien himself says is inseparable from his faith. That is why this is such a fantastic property to discuss in terms of apologetics and evangelism. There are so many doorways into discussions of faith by virtue of the fact that it's a singular creative work from a singular creative vision. And as far as the Rings of Power is concerned, the fact that the showrunners want to lean into that rather than excise it, even if they're taking liberties with it for the sake of adaptation, the fact that they are leaning into Tolkien and not trying to get rid of him is a great testament to the man's legacy, I think, and his faith.
I think one of my most favorite things about The Lord of the Rings is there's a small section in the appendices that really, again, religion isn't mentioned, but it really is kind of a treatise on providence about how all these different characters came to meet each other and how the fellowship was even started many hundreds, if not, you know, 1,000 years before. And so I thought that was really fascinating. So there's all kinds of different subjects that people can talk about with non-Christian friends. And the other thing is further up and further in, if people don't recognize that, that's from the Narnia Chronicles, the very last book, The Last Battle. Well, finally, I have a fun rapid fire question for Cole because it's November and it's going to be Thanksgiving in a few weeks. What is your favorite Thanksgiving dish that you look forward to eating?
There are two. Turkey, obviously, but we always make what we call deviled eggs, and I'm a big fan of those.
Well, thanks, Cole, for being a guest on the Postmodern Realities podcast.
Always a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
You've been listening to episode 314 of the Postmodern Realities podcast. Today's guest was Cole Burgett. He has written an online exclusive television series review for the Christian Research Journal. His article is called Tolkien Reimagined, a series review of The Lord of the Rings, The Rings of Power. Our subscribers can read his review for free at our website, equip.org. If you don't already subscribe, head on over to equip.org where you can get access to this article as well as our print issues to your door for $33.50. Stay connected with the Christian Research Institute and all the new content we have coming your way. The best way to do that is to head on over to our website, equip.org. There you will find thousands of free resources right at your fingertips, from articles to video to audio, and it's all for free. You'll find our podcasts hosted there as well as the Bible Answer Man broadcast, which is hosted by CRI President Hank Hanegraaff and streams live every Monday through Friday at 6 p.m. Eastern. In addition, you don't want to miss out on subscribing to Hank Unplugged, which is the podcast of Hank Hanegraaff. And in that podcast, he has really in-depth, free-flowing, essential Christian conversations with some of the most interesting, informative, and inspirational people. And in addition, he has a new series on his podcast feed called Hank Unplugged Shorts, which Hank goes into the headlines in the mainstream media and refutes a lot of those cultural issues that we have in these short podcast episodes. And there's quite a few of them. You don't want to miss out on them. Now, if you want to find some of this at other places where it's all in one place, really subscribe to our YouTube channel. It's a great way to get all of our content there, our podcasts there, and different individual questions theologically that people have that Hank answers at our YouTube channel. Now, you might be thinking to yourself, I don't know how to subscribe to YouTube. I don't have a YouTube account. Well, actually, you might just have a YouTube account. If you have a Gmail address, you have a YouTube account. Just log into YouTube with your Gmail address and search for Bible Answer Man channel, and please become one of our subscribers. In addition, if you see that bell icon right there on our front page, please click that. And every time that we have new content, you will receive a notification that new content is up on our channel for you to be able to consume. So thank you so much for the ways in which you partner with the Christian Research Institute. We are grateful for you listening and reading and watching.